What's up, Open Floor Globe? This is Ben Golver with the Washington Post. I am joined on the other line by Michael the Pod Pina of Sports Illustrated. Well, Michael, today we can't complain about the dog days, can we? I mean, all sorts of news coming down in every direction. Brooklyn Nets center forward, whatever you want to call him, LaMarcus Aldridge has announced his retirement abruptly due to a heart condition or a change of pulse that's really bothered him, I think, at various points of his career, required a procedure at one time during Portland. He had a racing heart during his last game and just decided, look, it was too scary. I don't want to take the court again. And he calls it, he calls it a career about 15 years in, just shy of potentially his first run to the finals or potentially his first ring. Just a real, quick, hard turn there for LaMarcus Aldridge. Then not too long later, we find out Michael Jordan's going to be presenting Kobe Bryant at the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame induction ceremony next month. Of course, last night was just jam-packed. Steph Curry is red hot. Luka Doncic hit a crazy game winner. There's just stuff going on in every single direction, Michael. But let's start with LaMarcus, because we've certainly given him a lot of discussion here recently. We named him a major X factor for these upcoming playoffs, and now Brooklyn's going to have to kind of pick up the pieces without him. I mean, first of all, what was your reaction when you saw the news? I imagine shock like most people. And what does this do for the Nets? How does this change their trajectory, if at all?
Yeah, I mean, when I first saw that he was retiring from the league, I was worried. It was so sudden that you'd think that something bad happened, and I learned about it on a text notification from Twitter, and then saw that he explained himself on his own Twitter account and on Instagram with everything that you've described with the irregular heartbeat and the fear there. So I went from concerned to relieved that he made this decision with his health as the priority, which is good. And then quickly after that, I was pretty bummed that I and everyone else never gets to watch LaMarcus Aldridge play basketball again. I have been a fan of his for years. And as you said, this was an opportunity for him to potentially win a championship or be a major factor on a title contender and in the starting lineup of a title contender. So it's just it's really sad, but I think it's a good time also to kind of appreciate and reflect on one of the better careers of his entire generation, in my opinion.
For sure. I believe 7-time All-Star, 5-time All-NBA selection, if I'm not mistaken. I know his Hall of Fame odds, and that conversation is always very heated on Twitter. Is he going to get it? Is he not going to get in? I think he's like 50-50 right now, according to Basketball Reference, or right on kind of a coin flip selection. My mind didn't necessarily go there immediately. I was thinking back to very early in his Portland career when I was first covering the Blazers, and he was having these kinds of episodes where it was diagnosed, but they weren't totally sure what it was initially. And then kind of abruptly, he had a number of different health scares along the way that required procedures, like I mentioned. And anytime you hear about that, whether it's LaMarcus Aldridge or Jeff Green, you just wonder, is this going to be something that completely changes their career? So I'm sure, and I get this from his statement, that there was a feeling of satisfaction and gratification for how long he was able to play. And I'm imagining he probably had some moments along the way there where he was thinking, well, am I going to be able to have a 15-year career? And so it does stop short here, but ultimately, it was pretty long and storied. We talked about this not too long ago, Michael, but you're driving the bus for his Hall of Fame candidacy, aren't you? I mean, now it's officially, if his career is over, we know where he ranks and everything. He was, pretty high among active players, like top 10 in a lot of major statistical categories before he retired. Is that enough to get him in?
I didn't go too deep on the statistics and what benchmarks he's crossed. I know he was just short of 20,000 points for his career. He was a winner. You highlighted the All-NBA appearances and the All-Star appearances, which all came in the Western Conference. And anybody who knows anything knows that being a forward and making the All-Star team in the West is very, very difficult. So for him to do it as many times as he did is very impressive. I just think he's one of the better big men of his time, and he was totally unstoppable. And I mean, I think back to when he was picking teams as kind of the biggest fish for that free agency class right before he selected San Antonio, and there was that whole thing about the Lakers were courting him. And I remember the Phoenix Suns like brought in, like they signed or traded for or acquired somehow Tyson Chandler and brought him to the meeting to surprise LaMarcus. And so he's just like a big deal. And he never, I feel like some of the detriment towards his case is based on his very low-key personality and his even more or equally low-key game, which is just a barrage of two-point jump shots, contested twos and fallaways. Like, that's not very exciting, but
he was just
a very, very good player.
When we're preparing his All-Star case, I think that we're going to want to focus more on how humble he was and how he didn't seek out the spotlight, and less on this idea that the highlight of his career was Tyson Chandler recruiting him to the Suns unsuccessfully. I'm not sure we're going to lead with that when we're describing how he should get into the Hall of Fame. But I hear you. It was just kind of a star-crossed career for him. You know, he comes in, it's supposed to be the big three with him, Brandon Roy, and Greg Oden. Obviously, that never materializes. He actually does emerge as this franchise-level player in Portland, but, you know, ultimately decides he wants to change teams in free agency, like you mentioned, goes to San Antonio, and he's just a few years too late. You know, he's kind of Tim Duncan's, like, very late career understudy. Duncan retires, Kawhi leaves, and now Aldridge is looking around saying, what happened here? Then he finally gets this last chance with Brooklyn, which was setting up really nicely. I thought he was their best option at center. I love Claxton, but when you're talking about some of the bigger, more physical players you have to match up with and some experience factor, it was clear they were going to rely heavily upon him in this postseason. And then this comes up, and he's not going to get his shot. So, you know, I think, you know, looking back, it's kind of a what could have been career, even though he played so long and so consistently, had a number of 2010 seasons. It just never quite all came together for him, but that's sometimes how it goes. You know, on this idea of matchups in the playoffs, Michael, you and I had, you know, wanted to start this conversation today with a look at the Philadelphia 76ers, because they did beat the Nets on national television last night. And of course, it was only half the Nets because Aldridge and Griffin and Harden and Durant all didn't play. But we saw very efficient, you know, very easy scoring from Joel Embiid. That's clearly going to be the kind of centerpiece matchup, you know, between those two teams if they do, face each other in the playoffs. And it was a big win for Philadelphia from a seeding standpoint, because it keeps them in that number one seed in the East and potentially knocks Brooklyn down into the second seed, which could mean a second round series with Milwaukee. And I think that whoever gets that first seed in the East is getting a really big advantage by only needing to deal with one of those two teams, right? So now that you're looking at how Brooklyn, you know, recuperates, I think the Nets call a team meeting and say, hey, DeAndre, how's it going, man? Good to see you. Glad you're still here. How's everything? You know, you're great. You're trying to mend those fences a little bit, right, Michael? But where else do you go from here? I mean, what's your move if you're the Nets?
I mean, I was thinking that same thing about DeAndre Jordan, and just like, you know, he was basically out of the rotation and wouldn't be in the playoff rotation. Like,
it's a good thing he's a nice guy, and it's a good thing Marcus Gasol is such a competitor for the Lakers, because these center rotation minutes are kind of getting scrambled. You know, it's a duck-duck-goose situation, and you never know when they're going to call on you, so I guess you just have to keep your mind right and be ready. You know what I mean? Because now Jordan's kind of back into that mix. He's going to get a lot of really important minutes in these playoffs. There's really no way around it.
He's going to get important minutes. I think Blake Griffin is going to get even more important minutes potentially. You mentioned Claxton, who is really versatile on the defensive end and has some nice touch in the paint too. And just, I think, is a better player than DeAndre Jordan. But I wonder how much this also kind of convinces Steve Nash to go even smaller and play some of the lineups that, if we ever see some of the lineups that we thought we would see before the season began, with Jeff Green as the nominal center and KD as the biggest guy on the court. Like, those are the lineups I'm really intrigued to see. I hope we see them in the playoffs at some point. But I'm not too worried about the Nets. As I said, when we did the X Factor episode, like I didn't even consider, I think I said like if Aldridge were to get hurt for the rest of the season, I wouldn't be like that nervous about Brooklyn. So no, I don't think my stance has changed.
No, you were wrong then. And now you're going to pay for it, Michael. That's the only way I can see it. No, I hear your point. I mean, it's not absolutely devastating, but they had, you know, assembled a deeper core there with different options. And, you know, depending on how things go across the course of a series, I could see that front line getting worn down or getting into foul trouble. I mean, we saw it with Embiid really having his way with Brooklyn, at least what was available last night. You know, before we dig into Embiid and how sensational he's been this year, I just think we need to tell the Sixers fans they made a big mistake on Wednesday night, Michael. They should not have booed Kevin Durant in the manner that they did. If the Nets and Sixers meet in the playoffs and there's a game in Philadelphia, I promise you Kevin Durant will score at least 40 points in that game. Write it down. Now, he was looking around all miffed on the bench. I'm sure you saw his reaction. Oh, why are they booing me? I'm not even playing. Big mistake. KD's not going to forget that, and you should have taken that one back, Sixers fans. I know you're happy to be back in the building. Everyone's glad to have fans back in the building when it's safe and appropriate. Big mistake, Michael. Big mistake. I'm calling it right now.
You said 40 in the game. He's going to have 40 at halftime. Like, I'm sorry. That was a big mistake. I totally agree with you.
All right. In all seriousness here with Embiid, I know you wrote about him this week. I got the sense that maybe you were doing some of your dork stat diving and coming across just some wacky stats, and you were like, I've got to turn this into a column. Am I right?
Is that what I do?
Well, you've told us before, you know, you like to kind of just dig in deep into the stat database. And when you find a number, you want to explore it and ask people about it and so forth. I think this was your explanation for your Clint Capella Defensive Player of the Year nomination column a couple months ago. I've got a pretty good memory here for your approach, Michael. I'm very interested in your craft, okay? Is that what happened here with Embiid as well?
So actually what happened was I was watching the Sixers-Celtics game from a couple weeks ago, and Embiid had this, it was like a Harden-esque step back, long two, where he just created, I mean, it was potentially a travel. I honestly don't even know if it was a travel. He was not called for traveling, but the way he created space against, I forget, I think it was Tice guarding him or Luke Kornet or someone like that, and just drilled an 18-footer with just like the sweetest footwork you've ever seen. It just got me thinking about his mid-range game. So then you look at some of the numbers and you're like, oh my God, he has been, you know, we just talked about KD. There's eight guys this season who have attempted at least 100 mid-range jumpers and made over 50% of them. And Embiid is one of them. KD is one of them. And then everybody else is also just an extremely good jump shooter. So the improvement that he made with the mid-range shot, I think, is revelatory and very significant in the postseason. And I compared it in my piece to what we saw last year with Anthony Davis in the bubble, where when defenses want to take away everything else from a big man, you know, everything in the paint, the rolls, the post-ups, they'll double you really hard, they'll get the ball out of your hands. If you can make a mid-range jump shot consistently and the defense can't, I mean, defenders like can't really do anything about that when you're making that type of shot. That's just not how basketball works. So if he can like sustain what he's doing in the playoffs, I just don't know like how he can be stopped at all.
So give me the number improvement, Michael. What was it last year and what is it this year when he's shooting the mid-rangers?
So from 16 to 24 feet, which is basically like a long two, the past two seasons he was at around 35-36%. This year,
which might as well just be a turnover, you know? I mean, pretty much.
Well, it's like, yeah, you're it's basically a third of the time and it's a two-pointer. So, and he's shooting it, which means there's a good chance that the Sixers are not getting the rebound. But this year he's at 60%. Which is like, you the volume is extremely high too. It's not like he's only taken 15 of these or anything like that. And the only guy who's better or more accurate on the same type of volume is Kyrie Irving, who's just having, you know, an absolute monster season shooting the basketball. So, there's a whole bunch of different numbers in my column, but that was the one that I kind of used to tease the story, just because it's absolutely wild. And
so let's frame it this way: if he had gone from 60% down to 35%, we would have said he probably had two simultaneous season-ending knee injuries, you know, the previous year. Like, that's the kind of impact that would have negatively. So when you flip it around, that's just absolutely wild. So let's dig into some of the reasons why that's happening. First of all, I mean, obviously spacing without Horford has drastically improved for Philadelphia, and I think that that trickles down to your quality of shot selection. There was an awful lot of just bad bailout shots from Embiid in the mid-range, the crazy fallaways, the leaners, the, you know, just desperation shots, hero ball shots in some situations. I do think he likes to be viewed as kind of this do-it-all big man, and sometimes he was just taking it too far. Anecdotally, from the eye test, I feel like he's tightened a lot of that up, and it's probably because he doesn't find himself in such, you know, dire situations this year, because they do have better spacing, and because I think he's in better shape and kind of can kind of get to things more quickly. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, having, you know, no Horford and no Josh Richardson, instead now having Seth Curry, Danny Green, Tobias Harris having the best shooting season of his career. There's just a lot more space to operate. And I just want to also quickly highlight my former editor, Mike Prada, at SB Nation. He wrote a really, really awesome piece about Embiid's balance on his Substack newsletter, and how Embiid's ability to kind of face up more this season has improved his ability to knock down those mid-range shots and those long twos. So I think that that's a factor as well. And I think, you know, Embiid said recently, I think it was after the Mavericks game, he kind of compared himself a little bit to Kevin Durant, or said that's the type of offensive player he wants to be. He doesn't want to be just a back-to-the-basket, like, old-school Shaq type. And yeah, Doc Rivers has kind of helped unlock that for him.
All the singers want to be Beyonce. All the big men want to be KD. It's just hilarious to me. I mean, AD, you know, he's doing the same thing, working on the perimeter game constantly. It's so strange because, you know, KD's given up 75 pounds to some of these guys, it feels like, and yet they watch him handle the ball. It's, you know, that looks like fun. I want to do that too. Embiid is a good shooter, though. Career 80% free throw shooter, and he gets to the line an awful lot. That's been one of the key strengths for this Philadelphia team, is him getting to that foul line, you know, just 11 times a game and really being able to deliver there. I think they might be number one in free throws or free throw attempts this season as a team. That's a huge advantage when you're going into the playoffs, especially if you're looking at undersized front line among the, you know, opponents, right? So that's mm-hmm. huge in their favor. But what you are seeing is that, look, this guy's shot selection was so bad in past years, and or his conditioning was so bad in past years, so he's settling for bad shots, that he's way below where he should be. If you get a wide open mid-range shot, I don't expect you to hit that at an 80% clip like you do a free throw, but it shouldn't be completely crazy and surprising that you can hit it at a really good rate. I mean, this goes back to the LaMarcus Aldridge thing. He was a great free throw shooter himself, and he was awesome from those elbows if you left him open. And that's kind of, you know, Embiid's got that soft touch. He's got good form. That's where it should be. I also think this conditioning piece, though, it comes through in a lot of different ways for Embiid. I mean, his three-point shooting number is up for sure. His overall shooting efficiency is up. His late-game performance, to me, has been much better this year. They're one of the best clutch teams in the league. Philadelphia is, which was never a guarantee, you know, based on some of their offensive struggles in past postseasons. To see them right near the top of that list has been great. And so, again, I think it's just a sign of everything coming together. This improvement in the mid-range shooting, to me, it kind of boils down a lot of the positive developments that we've seen for Embiid all into one number.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not even here to say that the mid-range should be his primary form of attack. Like, he should post up a ton, and he is posting up a ton, and he should take threes. He makes threes at a pretty good clip, I think 38% now. He was over 40% for most of the season. And, yeah, he's totally unstoppable around the basket. So, I mean, the number one thing that the Sixers should try to do is get him in front of the rim on every single possession. But just the fact that he's making them, the long twos and the mid-range jumpers, and the short twos too, at such an accurate rate, like, that just makes him, like, I don't know what you do against Joel Embiid. I don't know how you stop this guy.
No, you just, you know, trap the heck out of him and hope that somebody else can't beat you. I think that's going to be what happens in the playoffs for sure. It also goes back to what Embiid said, you know, during last year's playoffs, where he was so frustrated he didn't feel like he could use his body in the post. The referees wouldn't let him play. He kept getting called for offensive fouls with the elbows or the shoulders and trying to kind of, you know, pound people. And if he does get into situations in the playoffs where he has to play big minutes, but he's got two fouls early or he's got four headed in the fourth quarter or whatever, it's a nice little release valve too. You know, you don't want to just constantly throw him down there on the block and risk those situations. Now he can just step out and hit a more trustworthy shot. So it's been very strong for him. When you're looking at, you know, Philadelphia, though, it's interesting because the big guys have typically not necessarily, the traditional centers have not necessarily won matchup battles in the most recent playoffs. Now, the Lakers definitely won with their physicality across the front line with LeBron, AD, and Dwight Howard as well. A guy like Jokic, he's almost, you know, winning these battles not with his size, but with his passing ability and his own scoring ability and his two-man game. With a player like Jamal Murray, it's a much more outside-in approach. Do you think that Embiid has shown enough from a playmaking standpoint and a decision-making standpoint, you know, just like improvement, I guess, from last year's playoffs where that was regularly an issue, his turnovers, and they could have been, you know, fatigue-induced turnovers in certain spots, kind of coming back to bite them in key moments. Like, do you see a situation where if they play the Nets, I think that's the matchup everybody wants to talk about right now, where he winds up like being the central force of this series, or do you think that Philadelphia is going to be responding more to Brooklyn stars?
I mean, you know, you'll make fun of me, but I don't think that we should overlook the potential for a Sixers-Celtics second round series. I think that matchup's really fascinating. Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, I don't know who the Celtics are going to play in round one, but if they're in the 4 or 5 and they're playing the Hawks or the Knicks or the Hornets or I don't know which team.
Well, the single funniest playoff result this year would be the Boston Celtics beating the Philadelphia 76ers. I mean, that would just be so, so painful for Sixers fans, especially after last year. I'm not rooting for it, but I would laugh if that happened.
I would laugh as well. I would be filled with joy. But
take the Celtics matchup then. Do you think that Embiid can emerge as the most important figure in that series or that matchup? Because he didn't last year. It was Tatum.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, Embiid obviously has to be the best. I think he has to be the best player in every series if Philly is going to get to the finals. That includes a matchup against the Bucks. That includes matchups against the Nets, who have obviously Harden and KD. Like, I think that Embiid needs to, I mean, his regular season has just been otherworldly, but he needs to go up a level, honestly, in the playoffs. And it'll be fascinating to see just the attention that he's given, particularly late in games, where he gets his shots from. Is he able to get to the free throw line as frequently as he has? I mean, that is another huge part of a third of all of his points are at the free throw line. It's just like a massive part of his game. And, you know, in the playoffs, officiating is a little bit different. The defensive intensity and focus is completely on a different level. Opponents who really aren't able to like zero in on someone like Ben Simmons' weaknesses and not have their double teams as clarified as they would be. I think that is something also to look at. So like right now, I think Embiid's doing a pretty good job passing out of double teams. And you mentioned his conditioning, which has been, this is the best condition that he's ever been in his entire career. I think that like the playoffs are going to be a mental and physical slog for him because of some of the deficiencies some of the other guys on his team have. And it'll just be really interesting to see kind of how he battles through all of that and if he's able to persevere.
Now, I hear you for sure on trying to exploit the other pieces around Embiid as the method to sort of limiting Embiid. Like, I really do think that teams are going to just be selling out completely against him, and it's going to come down to all of their kind of secondary scoring options, including Simmons for sure, but also Harris and Curry, guys who are really going to have to step up and make major impacts because, you know, like, as you're saying, that mid-range weapon is massive. The low post stuff is going to be a big problem for the Brooklyn Nets. We saw him just pounding on Jordan last night. I do wonder, though, did Brooklyn rope-a-dope that a little bit? Did they want Embiid to feel good in that matchup before the playoffs so that maybe he tries to do a little too much or he feels like he's going to be the man and then they're going to be able to kind of use that, his confidence against him? What do you think?
I mean, I as an analyst of the NBA, I try not to, like, get too high or too low on basically anything I'm seeing in the regular season. And this is something I've mentioned throughout the whole year. Like, yeah, he was dominant, but, like, KD didn't play, Harden didn't play, Blake didn't play. It's just like, you know, what are we supposed to take from that? I don't want to totally diminish what he accomplished because he was an absolute monster and he was super efficient and he was getting buckets any which way, but it's just like the playoffs are completely different. they just are.
For sure, and I think that he bears a level of prove it as well. I mean, we really hit that point hard on the last episode about Tobias Harris, and it's like, come on, dude, you've got to step up. And with Embiid, it's about not just getting your numbers, which he was able to do in last year's playoffs, but it's about translating that to the positive impact and to being that main matchup guy. And I think that that's still an open question. I mean, I threw it to you, and it sounded like you were dancing around it a little bit, Michael. You weren't totally sure if that was going to happen. I think that's kind of a fair landing spot. I mean, he does still need to prove that he can be that player and do it consistently night in, night out during the playoffs. And his body needs to hold up through those extra minutes, that extra workload, and the extra just pace of intensity that we see in the playoffs. And I'm just glad he came back motivated and in shape and ready to rock this season because it's been really, really fun to watch the whole year long. And it's paying off with those numbers that you found in your piece. So I encourage everyone to go to SI.com and check that piece out. Okay, Michael, let's shift gears and pick up the pieces from the Jamal Murray situation in Denver. Now, his injury broke sort of pretty quickly after we taped earlier this week. Obviously a devastating blow for Nuggets fans and for people who were kind of hoping that the Nuggets would be potentially that biggest threat in the Western Conference to the Lakers or, you know, maybe even, you know, sneaking in a finals appearance if everything was, you know, clicking on all cylinders. Now, they responded to Murray's season-ending knee injury and ACL tear quite well, getting a nice win against the Miami Heat. And I do think when you show that it doesn't break you, now people are going to say, huh, okay, well, we still have to take these Denver Nuggets somewhat seriously. When you look ahead to sort of their postseason ceiling, what impact do you see from Murray's absence? Because I look at it and I say, it's going to be real hard for them to win a title without him. It's going to be real hard for them to win the West without him. But if they reached the, you know, second round or even potentially the conference finals, it wouldn't completely shock me because they do have some other pieces around Jokic. And because Jokic has been such a proven big impact playoff player in past postseason. So, you know, how do you see it, Michael? Like, what's their most likely scenario? What's their best case scenario? What's their worst case scenario? How do you kind of see this one shaping up for the Nuggets now that they don't have Jamal Murray?
I mean, it's a total blow, obviously. I mean, he's their second best player. If you were to take the second best player off of any really good team, any contender, they would no longer be a contender. That's how basketball works. I mean, when I look at the Nuggets, like you said, there's a potential for them to get to the conference finals. I see that as pretty unlikely. Like I can see them winning a playoff series because Jokic is just so masterful, and when he's on the floor, regardless of who else is with him, like he's gonna play over 40 minutes a game, I would imagine. And when he's on the court, it doesn't really matter who else is there because he can get a bucket from anywhere. One of the better post-up players, one of the better ISO players. He can pick and pop for three. And then just like the passing is just phenomenal. So the way he elevates teammates, like he's great. I can see them, you know, if Portland were to slide up to the five spot, I could see Denver beating Portland. I wouldn't necessarily pick Denver, but I could see them winning that matchup. And then the second round is where things get a little tricky, assuming that Denver stays in the four hole, which I think they will. Beating Utah in a playoff series, I don't know. I don't see that necessarily happening. Maybe beating Phoenix. I still would probably pick Phoenix in a series like that. But
well, Michael, here's what I would do on that exact point. Should Denver consider tanking here a little bit to six? Because if they get in that 4 or 5 with the Lakers, they're going out in the first round. You know, if the Lakers have their stars healthy, it'll be an interesting series. But I'm picking that one Lakers in 5. Maybe 5.5 if you want to be generous, you know, but I just don't see Denver having enough to overcome the Lakers stars. The matchups are already tough. Murray was so important to what they were doing in last year's playoffs. That one's pretty tricky. Now, I don't think Portland's going to be able to get enough momentum here to pass the Lakers in the standings, because the Lakers have a very easy schedule at the end of the season once LeBron and AD are expected to be back. So they're going to be closing with the push. And Portland is just kind of adrift right now. They can't guard anybody. Second worst defense in the entire league. It's been a mess. So everybody wants to play Portland, and I think ultimately they're going to struggle to even keep the six. I wouldn't be surprised if Dallas passes them. So if you're Denver, do you try to just get on the other side of the bracket, dodge the Lakers, get to six, and then take your shot at the Clippers? And then if you beat the Clippers, then you have a shot at the Suns. That's your path to the conference finals. You're not going to get through Lakers, Jazz to the conference finals, right?
I would say they have next to no chance beating the Clippers in a first round series without Jamal Murray.
No, I'm with you, but do you think they have a better chance to beat the Clippers than to beat the Lakers? Because that's what it's going to boil down to. They're two most likely, I've been kind of running through this with the projection guys, right? But they're most likely first round opponents. You know, it's like basically 4 or 5 with the Lakers, and they could be either the 4 or the 5. That's the most likely scenario, because there's just not that many games left for movement, right? Or they could drop if they wanted to, because they could actually control that and get to 6 and then try to play the Clippers. So is it worth doing that? Or do you just say, you know, whatever, if we get the Lakers, we get the Lakers?
I think if you get the Lakers, you get the Lakers. If you're the Nuggets, what your priority should be is, you know, making sure that Aaron Gordon is comfortable, or as comfortable as he can be, with more playmaking responsibilities, making sure Michael Porter Jr. understands that he's going to take, I don't even know how many more shots per game, but a lot more, and making sure that Jokic is in shape to play 40-plus minutes a game.
They don't have to worry about Joker. They also need to make sure Campazzo gets about 6-inch heels out there so he can match up a little better defensively with some people. Jokic is the least of their concerns, man. His playoff numbers are going to be absolutely wild, and I'm actually kind of looking forward to unleashed Jokic in the playoffs, because, you know, we saw a little frustration in that Boston game where I think he was feeling like maybe teammates are letting him down, or not everybody's competing at the highest enough level, right? No excuses in the postseason. Jokic will just put everybody on his back. It should be really, really fun. If I were them, I would seriously consider playing some of these seeding games, just because I really don't like that Lakers matchup for them. And I think kind of one of the unintended, if you want, I mean, winners is not the right word, but the unintended beneficiaries of Murray's injury is absolutely the Lakers, because they were looking at a situation where if they fell into the play-in, that was going to be their worst-case scenario. They're going to have this really tough path through the playoffs. If they can get, you know, kind of a hampered Nuggets in the first round and the Jazz in the second round, I think the Lakers are feeling great about that, don't you?
Yeah, probably. Can I zoom out with you for 2 seconds and ask you kind of a big picture Nuggets question?
Yes. Are they screwed? Is that the question?
Well, kind of. So we are left to assume that Jamal Murray is likely going to miss, obviously, the rest of this season. But then because of the timing of this injury, there's a good chance he misses all of next season as well, right? Or a vast majority of it.
Yeah, they put the timeline usually at 9 to 12 months. I'm sure they're going to be really careful with it. And, you know, nine months would be right around January. So you're still getting a good chunk of the regular season. If it's the full 12 months, you're looking at, you know, the start of the playoffs next year.
Which I don't think he's going to just come back and then play high intensity basketball in the playoffs. That just doesn't seem smart.
Wouldn't be ideal, no.
No. My question is, do you think at all this impacts Jokic's next contract? And just like, so let's like stepping back for 2 seconds. So they're not going to win. We're agreeing that they're not going to win the championship this season, despite being, I think a lot of people thought that they could win the title this year. Next year, if Murray does not play, which he probably won't, they aren't going to win the title next year either. The following year is the last year of Jokic's contract, and now he can probably sign an extension and lock himself up longer term there, but I think that he'd be leaving some money on the table if he were to do that. That 2023 season is the last year of Jokic's current pact. Like, do you think there's any pressure there on either side to, I don't know, win at the highest level? Like, if Murray comes back and he just doesn't feel like the same player, do you think Jokic is kind of looking around like, maybe I should explore other options? I am good enough to be the best player on a title contender, and I don't think I'm going to win a championship in Denver.
So are you a Top Chef guy? You know, I know a lot of podcasters out there love that show Top Chef. Are you one of those guys?
I've never seen Top Chef in my life.
That's surprising to me, because you're over there sharpening knives so you can jam them straight into the Denver Nuggets fans' heart. Michael, what are you doing? This is so painful. Why are you going to go straight and rip away their franchise guy right after they're dealing with their second best player? Just a catastrophic injury that's changing the course of their franchise. So rude, Michael.
And I'm just trying to think outside the box.
You're just asking questions. No, hey, look, I know. You're just asking the question. Here's the thing. I don't think that that will impact Jokic's decision-making. I think he's going to be one of these guys when they're like, hey, man, we're considering giving you $275 million. He's going to be like, yeah, yes, yes. Where what do I do? Yes, let's just do that. I do think it will impact them short-term and long-term. First of all, you're trying to put together a title group. He's got a big salary. We've seen what happens like with Kemba Walker, where, you know, that number sits on your books and it makes everything more difficult. And so in the short term, until Murray's back and close to 100%, it really hamstrings their flexibility. You can't trade him. You're not getting any production out of him. It's just a big hit. And like you're mentioning, it's taking you out of those conversations as title contenders. That in turn is going to take you out of conversations to compete with mid-level free agents and those kinds of guys who you're looking to kind of fill out your rotation this coming summer. Let's just be honest. If you're a free agent, Denver is a lot less of a desirable destination if Murray's not on the court and you can't trust him being completely healthy, right? Now, if you're the Nuggets front office, of course you're telling everybody this summer, don't worry, he'll be back in January or February. Plenty of time to get ready for the playoff. You know, that's probably going to be your public posture, right? But that's no guarantee, and that definitely makes it trickier. The other thing is that they've already got looming decisions coming down the pipeline with, in terms of Michael Porter Jr. You would have loved to be able to get a nice, deep postseason run or two with Michael Porter Jr. still on his rookie number. Once he comes up for that new deal, it could be time to choose between him and Gordon. You could decide to pay both and go into the luxury tax. But if Murray is not back to the player he was prior to the injury, I would imagine ownership would be less interested in just paying everyone and still running, you know, and chasing it and taking on the luxury tax and all that kind of stuff, because that's really never been Denver's MO. So there's a lot hanging on how quickly Jamal Murray can get back and, you know, how close he can get to 100%. I also think it's important to point out Murray is not just a jump shooter. I think most fans know that at this point, but I do think because of that arrow celebration and because, you know, he has had some crazy games where he just puts up just massive three-point numbers, and he came in with the Steph Curry comparisons, albeit unfairly, you know, he gets kind of labeled like that. He is really good going to the basket. He's really nifty finishing in traffic. He's not afraid to take some contact and throw up these crazy spinning layups. He might even dunk on you every once in a while, Michael, if you're not paying attention. How does the ACL impact that, right? Does that change how he plays in that first year back, the second year back? Does he become a little bit more perimeter oriented? You're really happy that he's got that three-point shot to fall back on, because that's going to, you know, really be able to extend his career regardless of the injury. But does it change how aggressive and how fearless he is going to the basket? Because he's not afraid to just put his head down and go. And I think that's going to be something that I'll be watching once we get closer to his return date and once he's back on the court and all that is – does the style of his play change in some meaningful way? Because that would certainly change his impact and his overall effectiveness on offense. So there are some absolutely big picture questions for the Nuggets fans. There's really no denying it. I would just say I'm not particularly worried about Jokic. He very much strikes me as the kind of guy where it's like, all right, well, who's ever around me, whatever. Let's just go do this and see what happens. And I think that their response against Miami was, it was very heartening. You know, it was easily this team could have broken in the short term and needed like a week to pull itself together. And that just wasn't the story. And I think that speaks well of both Jokic and also Michael Malone's leadership capabilities. Hey, Michael, I want to shift gears here to Steph Curry, because this idea just kind of hit me when I was watching him just go absolutely crazy again. And, you know, obviously it's against Oklahoma City, and, you know, right now they're pretty much, you know, throwing out G Leaguers right now. So it's not some huge surprise Steph's going for 40 plus in three quarters against them. But it's been a real tear here the last week. Golden State's, you know, they're feeling better about themselves, at least here temporarily. Is this a coincidence that Steph's doing this basically as soon as James Wiseman, the number two pick in last year's draft, goes out injured with a meniscus that I believe required surgery? Because all year long, the advanced stats have said Golden State's much better when Wiseman's not on the court, and that basically any minutes he's taking, the benefit would be his development, but the expense is, you know, short-term winning. Are we changing, or should we change how we look at these Golden State Warriors in terms of being a playoff threat now that they don't have Wiseman out there? In other words, are they actually more dangerous? Was this addition by subtraction in the short term?
I don't think it impacts what they are in the playoffs. They're a very thin team, and so like removing anyone, I don't care who it is, from your rotation is not good news. But yeah, the on-off numbers, particularly just like how they impact Curry with Wiseman, are kind of absurd. Like, I was looking through them, Steph Curry's scoring per 36 minutes goes from 25.9 points per 36 with Wiseman to 35.9 without. His three-point percentage, and I don't know how this like how this is Wiseman's fault. It probably is just dumb luck and a coincidence.
No, I don't think it is. I think it's like it's the difference between like when you're running with like mud and like wet shoes versus when you take those off and put on clean shoes and now you're just sprinting at world record pace. I think that's kind of the difference. I mean, Wiseman's been an anchor all season long.
A bad kind of anchor is what you mean, yeah.
Yes, like a weighing it down around your yes. ankle type anchor.
But Curry's three-point percentage goes from 38.1 to 44.1 without Wiseman. And since the All-Star break, his three-point percentage was 32.4 with Wiseman, which is just, I had to double-check that number, to 50.4 without Wiseman. Like, both of that disparity is like, it's breaking my brain reading it out loud and looking it on my computer screen right now.
Well, it makes sense, because Wiseman doesn't really space the court. He never really looked comfortable. If you're going to trap off Curry, he's the obvious guy to do it. And if you need to leave someone on kind of the backside and just crowd the paint, you can pretty much ignore Wiseman. And, you know, it kind of really cut into Golden State's spacing when he was on the court. There's no way around it. I mean, it was a consistent trend. That's why I do think we have to look at these guys differently, Michael. I don't want to play this version of Steph Curry in a play-in round. I'll promise you that. And I do want to watch this version of Steph Curry in the play-in round. You know, like we were talking about how much interest will this play-in actually generate. If you've got Steph out here averaging 38 or 40 points for the final month of the season because he's just going absolutely nuclear, people are going to want to see what he can do in that play-in round, no matter who they draw, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And I've thought that for the entire season, whether Wiseman is hurt or whether he's healthy enough to play. I think that one of the other factors and how detrimental he is for just how Steph operates is Wiseman isn't, you know, a high level passer. I think that that's like the big thing. And
yeah, he's not a release valve, and he's also not a spacer. So that you're 0 for 2 there. You know, everything that's great about Draymond, opposite for Wiseman.
Yeah, so that's not very complimentary, but no, I mean, like, in the play-in tournament, I'm kind of I don't want to say I'm like guaranteeing that Golden State will get the eighth seed, but like Steph is just gonna take like how many shots is he gonna take in these games, assuming that they're the ninth or the tenth?
Well, I hope an awful lot, and I also hope he gets a little bit. And I want the same thing for Giannis too. You guys are superstar level players, okay? Carry yourself like it. It's okay if Steve Kerr says, ha ha, you know, this game's over, Steph. Sit down. It's fourth quarter against Oklahoma City. You know, just take your seat. We don't want to run up the score. That's okay. He should be playing 45 minutes in the play-in game. You've been resting all season long. You're in your prime. You're a top five player still. None of this minutes management stuff. So I hope they really turn him loose like it's a game seven in the play-in. And same thing for Giannis in Milwaukee. I hope Coach Bud finally realizes you're allowed to play your stars more than 34 minutes a night, because if he doesn't, they're going to go out early. So I want the superstars to step up for their own minutes this year. I want to see some potential coach-player confrontations on the sideline over when it's time to sub in and out. No more Mr. Nice Guy after such a tough season. You know, get your shot. Take it.
You're very committed to the all-out, all-or-nothing play-in performance then, huh? Like, yeah, it's no, like, next year is kind of next year, and we'll worry about that when we get there. Let's go all in, win.
What are we waiting for?
We'll get destroyed by Utah.
What are we really waiting for here? I mean, come on, take your shot, right? I mean, that's kind of the whole idea. And look, if the idea was, hey, let's rest Steph Curry for the next month, let's ramp up Wiseman's minutes and role before he got injured and turn this into a developmental stretch and take a better draft pick, I would have been okay with that strategy too. But now you've kind of almost been forced to go the other way. There is no benefit to using this stretch as a development. Who are you going to be developing? You know, Andrew Wiggins, that ship has sailed. Kelly Oubre.
Jordan Poole, baby.
Forget about it, right? Yeah, exactly. So you might as well just go all in on Steph Curry explosions and see what can happen. Let him try to set some scoring records, go crazy. And, you know, if you keep him on the floor for longer than they have during this regular season, they're probably going to win more because they've been very careful with their treatment of him. So I think it makes all the sense in the world, Michael. Why wouldn't you do that?
Okay, so I have a quick question for you. If they, let's say hypothetically they get the 8 seed, they beat the Spurs, they beat the Grizzlies or whoever they have to play in the second play-in game. How many games are they winning against the Utah Jazz in a playoff series?
I feel like that's like a six-game series and Utah's sweating.
Wow.
I think they're sweating bullets. I think they're like, oh my God. We thought we were just going to be cruising and chilling, and now Steph is just out of his mind. I mean, I could see that scenario developing.
I don't think I can see that, honestly.
So what are you predicting? A sweep?
You know, I've been pretty favorable to the Golden State Warriors throughout this entire season. But no, I think in the playoffs when, I don't know. Like, I think Utah's getting, like, short shrift here. Like, they're very good. They're very deep. Steph cannot play 48 minutes. And
that's fair.
The way that
that's fair. I might be selling it a little bit thick. I mean, I'm just picturing a situation where they really do finally just go all in on Steph because everybody else has just kind of fallen by the wayside. And in that scenario, I could see him having like just at least one just masterful performance where Utah is just kind of left like looking around, you know. And we saw a couple of those they gave up to you know, Murray last year in the playoffs. So it's not like unimaginable, but Utah is definitely the more balanced team, the much deeper team. They're ready, they're focused, they're much more together. But I think that this unlocks an interest level for me in Golden State that just hasn't been there all year, because I thought they were trying to balance too many, you know, juggling acts, right? It was Wiseman, Curry, and this just gives them a very clear purpose. And it makes them much more lethal. At the same time, they're no guarantee to get through the play-in round either. I mean, that's part of it as well. Like these.
Nope.
Like, there's some good teams in there, and it would be, you know, kind of funny if everybody all gets excited about, you know, Golden State and, you know, Curry just for whatever reason doesn't have it that night, and now the season's over, you know. And hey, congratulations, San Antonio. Like, you know, you advanced to the least watched playoff series in NBA history against the Utah Jazz.
So this is random, and I'm sure you're going to get upset at me for taking time away from a potential question from our wonderful listeners. But did you have an opinion about Mark Cuban's comment over the play-in tournament and whether or not it was a good idea to implement this season?
Of course I did, but it sounds like you've got a strong one that you want to unleash. So go for it. No. You want to crush Mark Cuban? You think he's a whiner, don't you?
No, I don't want to crush him. I was just like, I understand his general point. I just think that if, like, what he's basically saying is that having games that matter during a season where the games are really stressful on the human body because of the schedule is a bad thing. But, like, didn't we already know this was going to happen heading into the season? And I think that maybe potentially he didn't foresee his organization being below the sixth seed, and now it's kind of getting dicey. But it makes sense to me. And, like, honestly, I think it's a great idea, the play-in tournament, I mean, because, like, all this stuff matters. And, like, in another world, in previous seasons, like, Zion Williamson would have absolutely no chance to make the playoffs, and now he can. And that's cool, because he's great, and his team is terrible, but he is great, and I want to see him just get the NCAA tournament March Madness style opportunity to just go ballistic for two games or one game or whatever and drag his team. And, like, that's fun. That's what we're talking about with Steph. We wouldn't even really be having this conversation if it wasn't for that.
Yeah, I think that they probably just underestimated how grueling this season was going to be from a, you know, game every other night standpoint, and from a lineup juggling during the middle of, you know, a crazy pandemic back in January, kind of putting a team like Dallas behind the eight ball early on, right? I think this season has just been a lot tougher than anyone could have predicted. I mean, even if you're expecting it to get rocky, you never know what it's going to be like until you're in it. And they've had a really, really tough season where they've been kind of trying to keep their head above water and, you know, make some late momentum after a really tough start. And so I think they're looking at it like, well, if the play-in didn't exist, we've got enough of a cushion over the nine seed so that we could kind of chill and get some rest nights for guys here and there and we'd be okay. And now they're seeing, well, basically, even though we've worked our way up to seven, we have to get to six so we don't have to deal with this play-in. And so now you're still in this chase mode, and it just feels like it's never ending. And you're seeing guys get injured around the league, and that's probably making you think, huh, I wish we could kind of, you know, go easier on our players, but we don't feel like we have enough leash or latitude to make that happen. So I totally understand where they're coming from. I always thought before the season it was kind of lame that you could play 72 games and lose your playoff spot because the result of one or two play-in games. I mean, I get the excitement factor. To me, the reward will only be worth some of these other risks and costs if there is major television interest in these games, right? So if 3 or 4 million people are watching the Steph Curry game that we're describing, then okay, that kind of justifies the entire concept. If we get to the end of this thing and there's like 35,000 people watching Bulls Pacers, I don't think we should bring it back. It's just not worth it. You know what I mean? Like, that's not really, like, all the, you know, the stress and the jockeying and all that, I'm not sure it's totally worth it. The other big benefit of this play-in round, though, was definitely the impact it had on anti-tanking, right? It didn't eliminate tanking. I mean, obviously, Orlando, Oklahoma City, Houston pretty much went south as soon as the All-Star break hit. But some other teams, including Chicago, wound up deciding, hey, we're still going to go for it. You know, Washington didn't have a sell-off. They're still kind of going for it. And I think that's generally in the league's best interest as a whole. It might not be in those teams' individual best interest, but that was a positive development. But to me, if we go back to a normal year next season with 82 games and you want to throw a play-in on top of that and then the playoffs, to me, that just sounds like an awful lot. The play-in sounds a little bit extraneous, and I would just prefer to go back to the old way. But I, you know, reserve the right to change that opinion if we get to the actual play-in and everybody's like, this is must-see TV, we have to watch it. And you go back to the bubble, all the excitement was actually before the actual play-in round. And we got to the play-in round, and it was like Portland, Memphis. Portland won. Everybody was like, oh, yeah, okay, cool. All right, well, Portland's in the playoffs.
Whoa. That game was awesome. Stop. But
don't you think the race to it was a bigger deal than the actual game?
Well, yeah, but that's kind of what it is, right? They want people to watch the games that lead into the play-in because there's more stakes, right?
Yeah. So I'm just not totally sure that they're accomplishing that goal right now because the bar is fairly low and a lot of these teams are just not very good. I'm sorry. Washington and Chicago, fantastic race for the 10th seed. Like, I don't really think people care about that nearly as much as media commentators discuss it.
You might be right. I think that those respective fan bases would like their team to make the playoffs, knowing that the lottery reform has really hurt the possibility of them getting a number one pick if they were to intentionally lose. So I think that one complements the other a little bit. And like, I'm personally all for the plan. I think it's fun. And if we want to decrease the stress on players and their bodies, just don't have an 82-game season. Let's just make 72 the number from now on and do the play-in and then do the playoffs, and it's great.
Yeah, I'm with you in theory on that. Personally, I wouldn't change it because I like the historical aspect of 82 games, and also I think it's a really tough sell right now to tell people, hey, let's make less money. You know, let's take out a whole bunch of home games in the middle of a pandemic. I think the owners are going to be saying no, not at all. And, you know, that's a complicating factor here too, is that they are trying to dig out of a revenue hole that was reaching like $3-4 potential billion dollars for this season. So whatever money the play-in generates, the league may view as good, you know, even if it's not this, you know, gigantic success, because they just have to find whatever ways they can to increase interest. And they may just say, well, even if it's not the world's biggest deal, even if it's a little bit of a dud like the All-Star weekend, it was better than nothing, which would be the alternative, right? And, you know, that's just kind of a shifting perception that we haven't really dealt with in past years. But, you know, I've been hearing from a lot of people around the league. There's been a couple stories this week. Frustration from executives and coaches are just about how players are overworked, how they believe that's kind of linked to the injuries. You know, that's a real developing narrative. I think the Jamal Murray injury kind of set that off even higher, because now all four teams from last year's Final Four in the bubble, the Lakers, the Nuggets, the Heat, and the Celtics, have all been kind of hit by, you know, pretty bad turbulence this year, all things considered. I mean, Boston hasn't been the same team. Miami's been, you know, a shell of themselves for a lot of the season, and the Lakers are without their two stars for more than a month. And so there's real questions about, you know, are we asking too much of these players? Is it actually coming at our detriment when you're having Lakers Nets on national TV and none of the star players are playing? That's not necessarily good for the sport. And same deal again on Wednesday night when it was, you know, Nets and Sixers. So there's going to need to be some real study and analysis of what's really in the league's best economic interest when it comes to the schedule, because this season really hasn't felt like that. You know, it really hasn't delivered a great product to the fans, and it hasn't delivered a fantastic television product either. I did want to ask you one final question here before we go, Michael. I know you're a pretty big anti-Mavs guy. That's why you brought up Mark Cuban's comments. You wanted to get some digs in at his expense. Did you see the Luka game winner, the floater from the three-point line off one leg, the push shot swishes through to beat the Memphis Grizzlies? Tough, tough loss for Memphis, who have been hanging tough like all season long. Some real playoff seeding impacts with this game as well. Just Luka magic. And, you know, I took a lot of heat, Michael, for saying Dallas is going to be one of the most entertaining teams to watch this season. How many other teams out there can give you that Luka magic like that shot? Not too many.
So I have, before I rebut here, I have a bone to pick with you, because I fell asleep early last night, did not get to watch the end of that Grizzlies-Mavs game, woke up, rolled over, opened my laptop. I was going to, you know, queue up the game, watch it in bed, and I opened my email first, made the mistake of doing that, and opened up your outline that you sent me. And one of the subheads is Luka magic. Was that game winner proof that the Mavericks are way more fun than you admitted at the start of the year? And I just got very upset at you for spoiling the end of that game. And
this sounds a lot like, you know, you're upset at yourself and you're projecting here. I mean, first of all, nobody made you go to sleep. Second of all, nobody made you check your email. And third of all, I bolded the subhead, so you had plenty of heads up, you know, realizing that maybe he did something awesome and you should rush back to your league pass and watch it. Michael, you got to take responsibility and accountability here. You can't push this back on me.
Absolutely not. It's 100% your fault.
Stop dancing. Give me the real answer that I want to hear. That game was so fun. Luka is incredible. The inbounds pass comes to his back shoulder. He's got two guys near him in pretty good defensive position. slips through both of them with that incredible feel for the game. Not very many people have that. And he's just so willing to be unorthodox. He's not even necessarily all that concerned with 1.8 seconds about getting a traditional shot. He just wants to get a clean, you know, angle or lane to the basket. And once he realizes with that just instinctual clock ticking in his head that he's running out of time, he flings this thing up with pretty good form. You know, I wasn't shocked that it went in when the ball left his hand. Now, I know he was surprised after the fact that he was able to pull it off. It was, you know, a little bit of a, you know, of a miracle shot. There's no question about it. You give it to him 10 times, you know, how many times does he really hit it? It's a fairly low percentage shot. But man, if anyone was going to take it and make it, it's Luka. The touch and the feel for the sport, I just love him. And he is so much fun to watch. And even you can appreciate it, this anti-Dallas hater over there in Brooklyn.
I don't think that that's a fair characterization. I did have fun watching it. I think I'm having fun, obviously, like everybody else, watching everything Luka's doing this season. And I mean, I felt bad for Grayson Allen, to be honest. I never thought I'd say that out loud. But him missing those two free throws, putting Memphis in that situation where they could be beat. Like, as soon as he missed the free throws, I knew that Luka was going to hit a ridiculous shot. I was just waiting to see how he could pull it off. And yeah, he is a total magician. Love watching him play. I still think that putting him as the Dallas Mavericks as the number one league pass team was incorrect on your part. And the proof is because I picked the Warriors. And did we talk about Steph Curry first, or did we talk about Luka first in this episode? Can you?
It's a fair point. Look, it also took me 4 months of games to get that kind of a moment where I could actually like make an argument on behalf of Dallas. I'm just saying, this is what I was looking for. This is what I envisioned, and I just love to see it from Luka. Who do you want to see them match up with in the first round? You know, we're talking so much about play-in, or can they get to six? And it's possible they do. You know, it would maybe be Phoenix. It would maybe be the Clippers. Do you have are you leaning one way or the other? Like, are you kind of hoping that Dallas can make a run, so you want a certain matchup? Do you just want to, you know, get the best possible first round matchup and just kind of let the chips fall? Where are you on Dallas's possible playoff matchups?
You know, I haven't given this too deep thought, but like, I don't think I'm that pumped about a rematch between the Clippers and the Mavs. I don't know. I feel like the Clippers are better this season than they were last year in a variety of ways, and I don't think it would be that competitive, to be honest. I think Luka would be great, and he could win a game or two single-handedly, but not that excited. The series that would be thrilling and could breed an upset is the Mavs versus the Suns. That would be fun for a variety of reasons, and giving the Mavs an opportunity to advance to the second round and giving Luka a chance to actually take down a team. Because I think that if you're just looking at the top of the bracket here, Phoenix is the most vulnerable of all the teams that they will likely play. So that would be cool, I think. I don't know. I wouldn't be that psyched to watch them probably lose again to the Clippers.
I hear you on that for sure. I think the Suns-Mavs is the one that everybody should be kind of rooting for because it guarantees new blood into the second round. You know what I mean? And they've also played some really interesting early season games before Dallas had all their guys. So there's probably like a thought in the back of the Mavericks' mind of like, hey, we got a chance against these guys if we have Porzingis back and everybody else is healthy and everything like that. And you'd definitely get some moments of, you know, both Booker and Luka trying to kind of, you know, show who could be this next young up-and-comer. I think that could be really fun. So I think I'm rooting for that one. I think I would still pick Phoenix there because I trust their defense a little bit more, and I think they've had more cohesiveness all season long. But I don't think Luka would go quietly by any stretch. He's probably got a couple 40-point games in him there. It'd be a really, really fun series. All right, Michael, I think we're going to have to call it there. We've got some amazing questions that we're going to have to roll over to next week. And guys, if you want to chime in on anything we talked about today, email us openfloormail@gmail.com, openfloormail@gmail.com. Michael, I understand. Did you get a book in the mail?
I did, yes. I cannot wait to dig in. And I thought you were trolling me with the choice of the bookmark art, which is great and everything, but there were two Lakers on my bookmarks, and so I gave them both immediately to my wife as a gift. I passed them along, I'm not going to lie. But
I understand that would be painful for you. So just to kind of clarify here, we sent Michael a copy of Bubble Ball, my new book, which is going to be releasing on May 4th. You got an early influencer copy, Michael. It came with two bookmarks. One, Anthony Davis peering around the corner in that famous picture from the bubble where he's sort of like, you know, eavesdropping on LeBron's press conference. The other one, LeBron smoking a cigar after winning, you know, the title, which the Celtics did not win, of course, there in the bubble. And so, you know, it wasn't personal to you. I just thought those were like maybe the two most, you know, representative photos that I took when I was in the bubble to kind of, you know, help just build a little buzz for the book. But I'll tell you, I did have a third possible bookmark that would have been an even bigger troll. Are you ready for it?
It's Bam Adebayo blocking Jason Tatum at
the rim.
Wow,
you nailed it, Michael. That was going to be the third choice. I almost did it. Maybe I should just do one personally for you. Actually, I think the bookmark maker, it's like a minimum count of 150. So, Michael, why don't I send you 150 Bam Adebayo blocks Jason Tatum at the rim bookmarks. How does that sound?
Just 75 of that play, 75 of OG Anunoby walking off the court after hitting that corner three. Yeah, just mix it up a little bit.
Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Hey, the Celtics have a little new life, so maybe we'll be talking about that next week. We'll have to see. All right, guys, you can find us on Apple Podcasts by searching for Open Floor. That's two words. When you find our page, scroll down. It will say rate and review. Tap 5 stars. It's just that easy to spread the word. I'm on Instagram at ben.golliver. If you have pre-ordered the book, hit me up. I can send you the aforementioned bookmarks free of charge. Glad to do it. If you're an Open Floor listener, just let me know. Send me a message on Instagram. I'm also on Twitter at Ben Golliver. Michael is on Instagram and Twitter at Michael V as in Victor Pina. All right, Michael, until next week, I will talk to you.
Talk soon, Ben.